Coming up next is Real People in the Psychotherapist Chair with Jerry Pives.
Well, it's the weekend and you're listening to Real People with me, Jerry Pives, in our brand new weekend slot. I've been promoted. Thanks to all of your listening. And now we get to spend the weekend together. What a great show I've got lined up for you today with our guest, the one and only Rachel Stewart, who many of you have already probably heard speak on RCR. She was New Zealand's first female train driver back in the 1980s. She's been journalist, writer, and now ex-New Zealand Herald columnist, winner of the Opinion Writer of the Year, the 2016 Canon Media Awards. DNA is rural, ex-president of Whanganui Federated Farmers. She's a hunter, falconer, conservationist in the true sense of the word, and a believer in biology at all costs. She's a right good un, as they say, all the way up in Yorkshire, where I spent a lot of my life. And today, you're going to learn how a Kiwi farm girl ended up in the bright city lights of San Francisco at the tender age of 11. You're going to discover how she stood up and protected her mum at the young age of 16 and has not stopped fighting for justice since then. We talk about sleeping with cows in the meadow, San Francisco in the early 1970s, how to deal with our family and the cultural and family baggage that we carry. So in the second segment of this show, I'm going to be teaching you all about probably one of the most important concepts in psychology, the idea of a life script. And finally, in the third segment, you're going to hear seven great tracks of music, including Patsy Cline, The Verve, Linda Ronstadt, and London Grammar. So here we are now. Every fortnight, I'm going to invite you to get into that Saturday morning feeling at 10 a.m. with me, or join me again for tea and muffins at 4 p.m. on Sunday afternoon. What could be better than listening to real people talking about their real lives without all that flim-flam of fame or trying to sell you stuff? Sit back and relax as you listen to Real People in the Psychotherapist Chair with me, Jerry Pives. But to get us in the mood, let's have a listen to the great Sashmo singing What a Wonderful World. Well, you've just been listening to What a Wonderful World by Louis Armstrong. And depending on how you look at it, it can be a wonderful world. Today's pretty wonderful for me because, Rachel Stewart, you're here in the psychotherapist chair. A big welcome to you.
Thank you. And that's so spooky that you just said that you played What a Wonderful World. I can't quite believe it because I nearly put that in my first pick of songs and I chose not to in the end, and you played it anyway.
Well, you wouldn't be the first person to say that, Rachel. It's okay. Such an all-time favourite, isn't it? And it's so uplifting. And I put it on at the beginning of every one of these shows because I want to start with a positive vibe. You know, I want us all to feel that no matter what's going on, we can still find things in this world that are truly unbelievably wonderful. This morning, before we recorded, I just had 5 minutes outside. And I was looking across to the mountains here in Wanaka, and I thought to myself, really? How can you ever let yourself get down when all you've got to do is walk out your door, Jerry, and look at those beautiful snow-covered mountains?
If only it were that simple, Jerry, we'd all be mentally so healthy, but unfortunately it doesn't seem to be as easy as that sometimes.
Well, and that's why this show is here, really, because I'm talking to Kiwis all about how they lift themselves, how do they cope with trauma, and what gets them out of bed in the morning. And I wonder, we could start off, Rachel, many of the listeners will be very familiar with your voice and you, and you've been on RCR lots of times, and you've contributed massively to the free speech and reality debates that are going on this station. So big thank you for that. And to the listeners, you can check out, if you just go to replays and you type in Rachel Stewart, you'll find all sorts of wonderful recordings of Rachel. But I wonder if we started with what works for you? What lifts you when you're feeling a bit low and you're feeling a bit flat? What do you do to give yourself a lift?
Well, you know, when you get too flat, it becomes very hard to even know what to do. But I haven't been that flat too many times, but I have been very flat for periods of time. But generally I get outside, I take the dog, we go and shoot a possum, I might go hunting. It's generally outside activities. I never make any big decisions inside. I always make any big decisions when I'm outside about life. So I guess it's definitely being out there with my dog and feeling the wind in my face and feeling the rain and the sun. And so, yes. And you know, little things like doing Wordle. That helps. Puzzles. Yeah. You talked about, I listened to your one recording about depression, which I really enjoyed. And you talked about yourself there when you were younger and you started doing jigsaws. You became obsessed with jigsaws. I don't do those, but I definitely do the New York Times crossword. And I totally relate to that because it gets me out of my head and I'm a word person and it really helps me a lot. So getting out of bed in the morning, I've got to get out of bed because I have animals to tend to. And when you have an animal to tend to or animals to tend to, you get out of bed. So that's been a very constant and very big constant in my life. And I'm very grateful for it.
What animals have you got, Rachel?
Well, at times I've had, stock to tend to, sheep, cattle, dogs, heaps of dogs, farm dogs. And obviously, of course, when I was terribly involved in falconry, you might have a hawk you had to feed and take out and do things to. So, you know, who knows? And there's always animals to go and keep away from the house, like wild pigs or goats. And while I may kill them, I still love them.
Yeah. Animals are amazing, aren't they? There is something profoundly soothing about animals. And I don't know whether you knew this, Rachel, but during COVID, the number of pets that people that were sought after by people exploded. People were looking for pets all the way during lockdowns, and the various agencies that have rescue pets or whatever, they couldn't get enough pets in, from what I've heard, that so many people were suddenly recognizing their need for animals when they couldn't have human contact.
Well, sadly, of course, there's the other side, the dark side to that, is that then they abandoned them as soon as COVID was over and a lot of people went back to work. They were handing them into the SPCA like nobody's business. So there is that side of humanity that's I can't really relate to. Yes, and a lot of people fell in love with animals at that time and were great and have been great owners because of it. But I think the animals suffered a bit because suddenly people weren't home, you know. But I find animals are a constant theme in my life. When I was very young, I used to go and sleep. We had a dairy herd, of course, and I'd sneak out at 11 o'clock at night and go and sleep with my favourite cow and sleep on her udder. And then just before milking, when I could hear the dog starting up, I'd sneak back in so Dad didn't know I was out there with the cows. You know, I found them very comforting.
Wow. Really?
Yeah, really. Not so much in the middle of winter. But, yeah, in summer I definitely went and slept out there with them and slept on their udder and I cuddled up to them and they were just absolutely fine about it. I had a particular favourites and they were like, the cow's udders are so comforting, warm and milky and, you know, I didn't do anything kinky out there, but I certainly enjoyed their company. I love cows, yeah.
And that would be outside or in a barn?
Outside, yeah.
Wow. Wow, I've never heard that. I've never heard of anyone doing that, Rachel. That's just blown me away.
Oh, really?
So how old were you when you were doing that? How old were you when you were going out and sleeping with the cows?
Oh, probably. It's a bit strange now. But, yeah, probably from on the farm, probably from five to about 10.
Wow.
Yeah. I knew my parents wouldn't want me out of bed doing that. So I don't think they ever knew.
Amazing.
It was
great. Amazing. Yeah. It's funny when you're little and you do things and it just seems perfectly normal when you do it. And then later on when you grow up, you think, oh, that was a bit odd. I used to, when I was about 6 or 7 years old and started at school, I was really struggling. I had some form of dyslexia and I couldn't get on with the school and I didn't think much of the school. And I used to just... At the break time, in the morning break, I used to just, you know, when everyone went back at the end of the morning break, I just used to hang out around one of the corners and then I'd just go outside the school gates and wander into town. And I used to sit down and have coffee like a grown up at the age of 7. I can't believe the coffee sellers would have even wondered, why is this 7-year-old boy walking into a coffee house? And I crossed like the main arterial road between the school and the all the shops. It was in a tiny little town called Lee-on-Sea in Essex in England. And I the main arterial road from Southend to London, it was like 4 lanes I had to cross as a 7-year-old to get to the shops. I used to wander around. I'd smell the coffee and I'd go in. And I did this, I think, kind of almost every day for about 3 months before someone noticed.
That to me is something I've never heard of before. So there you go. I mean, well, we just called that wagging school. But the coffee part, going and sitting and having a coffee, that's fascinating.
Yeah, it was something. So it just strikes me that it was only many, many years later that I thought, well, in fact, when I became a school teacher, I thought, that was a bit weird. Nobody noticed.
Now you've pointed out about the cows. I hadn't thought of that for a long time. It is probably a bit weird too, but yeah, well, maybe
I think
not,
it's
but
beautiful.
I really enjoyed it.
Yeah, I think it's beautiful, beautiful. And tell us a bit about your childhood, Rachel. Tell me where you grew up and tell us a little bit about what your sort of childhood was like. I'd love to hear that.
Well, I grew up in Whanganui, of all places, in the North Island on the West Coast, born into a farming family. Father was Whanganui-based and had taken over the farm from his father. My mother was from a farming family in Taranaki. Taranaki, I should say correctly. And we had a dairy farm and a sheep farm. Dairy farm was pretty, maybe a few miles out of town, and it was one of the first in the region. We had, I think, the oldest cow shed in the Whanganui area at the time. And then the sheep farm was another 4 miles up a side valley road. And so we were living the dream. I mean, I was the youngest of four, and you could go anywhere you wanted pretty much. Although going out to sleep with the cows probably wasn't on the list, but you could go anywhere you wanted during the day. You could sled down hills. I used to make sleds go down hills, chase my older brothers and sister around. We had dogs, we had animals, we had everything. It was, I felt like I was sort of king of the castle in some ways. To have land that you can always access and do things, go and ride a horse or that's very special. My parents split up when I was 11, unfortunately, or fortunately. And I then was whisked away with my mother because I was the youngest by quite a bit. And we moved to the States. So that became a whole new chapter. And that was a bit of a shock, really. But it's something I'd never change. Of course, you can't. But it was great experience being in California in the 70s. It was fantastic being in San Francisco and going to Haight-Ashbury and seeing, you know, the Castro, and I'm like, you know, I'm from Whanganui. I mean, the highlight of a Saturday night in Whanganui in the 60s and 70s was going to the pie cart in the main street. So suddenly I'm, you know, suddenly I'm coming, going to Berkeley, you know, and seeing the university and seeing gay cops, you know, and the world was, I mean, we'd just come out of the 60s. So it was the place to be. And that was a major change for me and changed my life enormously forever, and my relationships with my siblings, probably not for the better. And relationship with my father changed, and it was okay. Relationship with my mother really changed. So I went there in 1970, end of 73, and came back in 76. So I went from 11 till 15, roughly.
Pretty important years for a young girl, right?
Very, I think. The music, the times, the politics. I've got a very deep understanding of American history, which I enjoy, and politics, not so much these days, but it's still interesting. And coming back to Whanganui in the middle of the, at sort of somewhere at the end of the fourth form, I think it was, being plunged back into Whanganui Girls College, picking up with all my primary school friends, because I'd sort of missed out intermediate by going to the States, and coming back to live with Dad, and coming straight back, it was like that never happened in a way. It was very odd, and I was never the same person. And I struggled a bit academically originally because I had come from a very loose arrangement in California. I found their education system incredibly easy. And if you're good at sport, you sort of got through. But I got back into it and did Latin and French and did okay. So it was just, yeah, it was a very interesting time, and it's had a huge impact on me.
I can imagine. And, you know, looking at it from the outside, I'm so jealous of anyone who spent the early 70s in San Francisco.
Yeah, shame I wasn't like 23 instead of 13, but there you are.
Yes.
But it still, it got into me by osmosis, and I think I picked up on a lot of the California vibe of the 70s, where the world felt like it was just like you felt you're on the cusp of something completely fantastic. And I think they were interesting times too. It's all been downhill from there.
I tend to agree with you, Rachel. I mean, interestingly, in my field, psychotherapy, within I think about an hour's drive of each other, three of the greatest creators of revolutionary approaches to dealing with pain and the psychology of pain, they all lived within an hour of each other, and at least two of them met up. And that was Eric Byrne, who founded the approach I use, which is transactional analysis. Fritz Perls lived, you know, just a short way away, and he founded Gestalt therapy. And Carl Rogers lived not very far away, and he founded person-centered counseling and therapy. So, and those three approaches have spread across the whole world, and they all originated right over there in San Francisco. There must have been something in the water, I reckon.
Yeah, it was a fabulous place. And I still cry when I leave San Francisco. I don't cry very often in my life, but when I fly out of there, because I've traveled back regularly for years, and when I fly, particularly when I fly in, actually, I get very emotional. It is not the same place now. It is, and so now I'm crying for different reasons, but it's still somewhere I left my heart, definitely. And it was my favorite city in the world, and probably still is in a fictitious place in my head, because it's not the reality now. It's changed, but it's a beautiful city. It has spawned great thinkers, great progress, and great liberality, if you're into that. Unfortunately, we're in a whole different paradigm now. But yeah, wonderful, wonderful place. And I loved going to school there. I loved growing up there in the early teens. Yeah.
And I wonder, you know, would you be willing to share what it was that led your mum to leave and to go across there? And it sounds like she didn't come back with you. She stayed out there?
She stayed out there for a while, but they did come back. She left my father after 19 years of marriage. It wasn't a happy union, certainly in the last few years. I mean, they had separate beds at a time when I don't think that was a thing, really. Now it's quite a thing, even if you're happy. But they just weren't, they didn't, you know, we'd sit there and mum would say, tell your father to pass the salt, you know, this sort of thing, you know, Sunday. So it was crazy stuff. I only got the tail end of it. The older siblings probably saw a lot more than I did. But anyway, she left very soon after she met a man, or maybe she met him before, I don't know, who was an American who was back in New Zealand for a school reunion, because he'd gone to school in Whanganui when he was very young. He was a Scotsman, actually, but he lived in America for years. He was an American sailor. He'd been in the war, Marines, I think. And she fell in love and said, we're going to San Francisco. How do you feel about that? And there was a bit of lead-in time, and I felt nervous and excited in turns. And the day I left to go there for her new man and his life in San Francisco, I was, yeah, scared to say goodbye to my family and totally excited about getting on a DC-10 and flying to LA, because you couldn't go direct to San Francisco at that point. You couldn't even go direct. You had to stop in Hawaii. I remember that. So yeah, it was scary time, but it was also very, made me grow up heaps, I'm sure.
And you had three elder brothers and sisters then?
Yeah, two older brothers and a sister, yeah, who were old enough not to come. All of them had left school. The older one was a policeman by that point, very early, young. He was 12 years older than me. The next one, my sister, is 10 years older than me. And she was at university, teachers' college, so she wasn't going to go. And my older brother, who's 5 years older than me, was working with Dad on the farm, and he'd left school, so he wasn't coming either. So it was goodbye to all of that. And when I came back to Whanganui after, 4 years away or 3.5 years away, it was picking up where I'd left off. It was, it was surreal. It was like I'd been doing the psychedelics that I wasn't doing, but everybody in San Francisco was.
So did you decide to come back? Was it your decision? Was it your mum's decision? Was it your dad's, who at the age of, 15 when you returned? I'm fascinated at this moment in your life.
Yes, well, I'll tell you what it was. It was that my stepfather and I weren't getting on, and I didn't like him particularly at times, although at times I thought he was great. He was a drinker, and he would beat my mother with monotonous regularity. Around about once every few months, and that morphed into him trying to beat me one day and my mother intervening, and I was on a plane within a week, and that's why I came back. But there was a lot of trepidation about that too, because I thought, if I come back and leave her, he's going to kill her. And he didn't, but I worried the whole time I was home, and it took her another year and a half to come back, and they moved back to Wellington, and he worked on the tugboats in Wellington before he died, quite young, at 52, I think it was. So, she did survive it, but I always worried about her. Mm.
And that's really interesting, because one of the themes that recurs in this program, Rachel, is the effect of trauma and how it passes through sometimes many generations. And I think you described your stepfather as having been in the war. Is that correct?
Yes.
Yeah. And do you know what theatre of war he was in, or where he was, or anything about that?
Yes, he was. I know he was in the front line in Dunkirk. He was on boats. He was, he had a lot of stuff. So, I look at it now and realise what's going on for him probably. But it didn't change the fact that as a child I was very scared of him, really.
Well, yes. And was it your mum who sent you away, who decided, okay, that's it, she's got to go back? Yeah.
Yes.
So her protective instinct kicked in, and it was okay for her to be beaten up by the sound of it, but not for you. And that crossed a line for her. And I can just imagine how tough that would have been for you to have left your mum, knowing that on a regular basis, this highly traumatized guy, and how often do we get trauma followed by booze, followed by violence? It's almost, you could almost say it's the Kiwi pattern as well. I've come across this a great deal here, probably more than I did in the UK. I don't know why I say that. It's just very heavily populated in the UK. But here in New Zealand, people I've worked with, people I've met, so very often this is not the same story exactly, but of the pattern of, trauma like a world war. And of course, we then lay on, I wonder if your stepfather, I wonder if his father was also in the First World War. That often happened, for example. I don't know if you know that happened.
I don't. I don't know much about his background at all. But I can tell you that, and this may shock some viewers, but some listeners, but I'm going to talk about this because I found it pretty cathartic. They came back and they moved to Wellington, and my mother said, come down for a weekend. And I thought, okay. So I caught a bus, and I was still school. I was probably sixth form or something. And I took the bus down for the weekend, and they'd moved, bought a house somewhere in Wellington and Parramatta, I think. And I went there for the weekend, and he decided to get drunk one night. And I thought, oh, here we go. I wonder if he's going to do it now. And I was a bit older. I'd been home for a while. I was in my own country. I had my siblings, in the back of my mind that were my backup, I thought. And he started hassling her, and I thought, here we go, he's going to start doing it. And he started chasing around the room, and then I said, you are not going to do this here. And I just went to grab the phone to call the cops, actually. And he goes, I won't do anything. And I put the phone down, and then he pulls the phone out of the wall. And I remember thinking, okay. So then he chases her, slips over, falls over because he's drunk. He's on the ground, and I take my opportunity. And I kicked him like you wouldn't believe. I broke two of his ribs. He couldn't go to work for a few months, told everyone he fell off a ladder. I said, if you touch my mother ever again, I will kill you. And I meant every word of it. And he, you know what? According to my mother, he never did. He was a 16-year-old girl, 17 maybe, beating up a 50-something-year-old, 40-something, maybe late 40-year-old man, and he was terribly embarrassed, lied about it, but he never hit her again. So in some ways, and I've never done anything like it ever since, I've never had to be in a position like that, really, but I think in some ways it kind of worked. I think it woke him up a bit, and he never drank again like he drank before. So that was that.
Wow. It sounds like you shocked him into some realization that he had to change something.
Yeah. Well, I was back in my country. You know, you're in my country now, man, and you're not going to do that to my mother. So that was it. And I have a belief that if more people took responsibility for this kind of behavior before it gets to this point and possibly do what I did, maybe not the violence part, but it's what happened. I think it was all pent up in me and it just came out. And, you know, it changed his behavior. If more men stepped up, for instance, when men hit their sisters, their mothers, I think we'd have less of a problem, but they don't tend to do it. They certainly don't tend to do it in this country. So they stay away. It's not my problem, you know. Well, I think it's all of our problems. I hate domestic violence.
And how big a theme in your life has standing up for justice, standing up for against damage and harm to people or animals, or I suspect the land as well? How much has that been a theme of your life, Rachel?
Well, I haven't thought about it too much, but if I was to think about it, and I am now, it's been the biggest theme of my life.
Yeah,
probably. I mean, it's something that I've always done. If I don't like injustice, I believe in justice and fairness and truth, actually. And I'm not a person who you can just tell me it's something black when I know it's white. It's just not something that I can do. I think that's the rural aesthetic. We don't really work like that. My whole life I've been in a lot of trouble for standing up for some things. It's a theme. It's cost me a lot, actually. Cost me a lot financially, but it's also cost me a lot emotionally. But you know what? It's one of those things you just can't change about yourself. I mean, I don't go out of my way. You know, people say, oh, you're brave and you're courageous. Or I don't go out of my way to be any of those things. I just don't think I got the gene where you have fear of speaking the truth. And going into the world that we're in now, where free speech is definitely on the wane, people don't want it. And I say what I think about certain things. It's a dangerous time for people like me. Of course, in Britain, you know, with all this stuff happening at the moment, with the immigration riots and Keir Starmer calling people right-wing thugs as a moniker, which it's too easy. People are getting locked up for just liking a tweet. So we've got massive problems that we're going to be facing, and a person like me could be in jail very soon.
Well, I'll be right there next to you, sister.
Good. Good.
There'll be quite a good crowd in there. It'll be quite a party, I suspect.
Yes, I think so. I don't know where this is all leading, but a person like me is well-equipped emotionally to withstand these times quite well. And I've had years of this, so I'm watching with great interest but great trepidation too, because these times of nothing like you or I've ever seen. Jerry, I'm sure you agree.
Well, I do. And you know what, Rachel? Even if I didn't agree, I'd be happy to hear your opinion, right?
Yes, and that's old-fashioned and it's decent, and that's what I like. And, you know, we were brought up to be stoic. I mean, stoicism is kind of the rural psychology, to be honest. And part of me to this day still feels like I'm a very honest person, so I tell the truth, but I struggle telling people those stories I just told you, really. But I've started to do it more and more as I've got older because, you know, it feels like it's something people could use and possibly learn from. I don't know. Or, you know, at least they learned something about me. But I still struggle these days to kind of really, I struggle with what I call the victimhood of sort of wokeness. I struggle with laying everything on the table and saying, oh, I'm triggered and I'm offended and all, you know, I just don't really do that. So it's, yeah, I can get offended, but I'm not going to make a big federal case out of it. It's, yeah, and that's just part of the rural DNA and it's still hanging around. It's still there. It is tough work. It is hard. It's hard to be farming and it's isolating and you need a different kind of spirit and from the average person. If you don't have a certain degree of stoicism, it's not an industry to get into. And so I guess it's a hangover. You know what, though? I kind of prefer that to hanging it all out. I mean, there's a place to hang it all out, probably talking to someone like you, you know, right now on radio, or in the therapy chair. And I do have a therapist I go to from time to time, and that's where I go and do it. But in my personal life, I tend to just laugh stuff off as much as possible, and I don't really show people that underbelly. I don't expose myself terribly strongly, but here I am doing it with you. So there you go.
Well, and there's always a balance here in a public radio show like this, in that anything that is too exposing, you don't know what listeners are making of it. I mean, I think most listeners are just incredibly grateful at hearing real stories from real people on a real station. And I think that has a power all of its own. It's why I do this, because I think there's a need for us to talk more. And I think there's a need for us to know that it's okay. But you're right. You're right, Rachel. There is this incredibly powerful, determined, strong, stoic character to a great deal of New Zealand. And do you know, it's a quality I actually admire. Despite being in my profession, I absolutely admire it. How many generations back, Rachel, does farming go in your family?
Oh, yeah, it goes a long way back from what I can figure out. Both sides of my family are British, clearly. My parents were born in New Zealand, but both sides of their family are from Yorkshire, as much as I can gather. Yes, and Lancashire, actually. So that's right next door, I think. So, yeah, and in my family, it goes back forever. I mean, I had a grandfather who, my father's father, came back from the Boer War and World War I, and he did mustard gas, and then he killed a Chinaman and got away with it. There's a whole book about it, and I'd never met the man. He was well dead before I came along. But again, he was such a stoic guy, and he went a bit mad with the mustard gas. He got whatever they call that, something. There is a word. It's a great book. It's called The Murder of Chow Yat. It's written by Joan Rosier Jones, and it's a fascinating read about New Zealand history, actually. But my grandfather clearly did it. And I'm quoted in the book as knowing that because my aunts told me that he said to them, I'll cut your throat if you tell anyone I killed the Chinaman. But he never got caught for it because he had medals. You know, he was a big and he was a strong man. He'd go into town. He'd take the horse and cart into town from the farm about once a month. He'd get on the terps in town at the old Rutland Hotel, and he'd pick on a bald man and he'd start slapping him around the head. I've heard these stories from people that, you know, was handed down. And he'd pick a fight and then he'd just beat the crap out of them and then come home in time for milking the next day and feel better. So this is the sort of DNA in me. I don't know that I'd go and do that, but yeah. So it's a long line of this kind of thing. And they were military people too, when they had to be. So that brings a whole nother dimension. And I think, like, I had to agree to talk to you, Jerry. I had to think about it. I said I'd take a day to think about that when I was asked to talk to you, because I felt that was talking to you might be, you know, a bit weak, or do I really want to talk to Jerry about, you know, psychotherapy or anything going on with me? Or then I thought, no, bugger it, I'll do it. because I listened to some of your shows and it felt good, it felt safe, it felt fine. And also I do see a therapist, and the reason I see a therapist from time to time, and it's not a weakness, it's just something that keeps me going, was because when I came back from that Wellington experience with my stepfather and a few things started to happen, I got into my early 20s and I thought, oh, I'm just not coping here, you know, this isn't going well. So I went and saw somebody at the Polytech in Whanganui who was, I don't even recall who she was, but she was brilliant. And she said, I do CBT, this is how I work. And I didn't have a clue what any of that meant. And she said, what's going on for you? And we had six free sessions. I remember it was covered by the government for some reason, I don't know. And it's so long ago. And I remember talking to her and she said, tell me about what happened with your mother. And, you know, we got into it and I just start crying. You know, I kept thinking, why am I crying? This is bizarre because you just don't cry in my family. You're not supposed to cry. So she teased it all out of me. And then she said, and I remember the turning point where I really had respect for her and what she was doing. She said, now, tell me about your nieces that you adore. And at that stage, they would have been 8, 10, 12, something like that, because I've got a bunch of nieces and nephews, and now great nieces and nephews. And how would you feel if they were in that situation that you just described to me when you were 8? And I remember going, oh, yeah, I could actually relate to that because I felt for those kids. I loved those kids. I still love those kids. And I suddenly realized that was me, but I couldn't give myself permission to feel sad about me, but I could. And so she changed the way I look at things now. I'd always put someone I love in that situation and think about how I'd feel for them, that thing that happened to me. And yeah, so that's when I got respect for what you do. And I just see it as part of my life. So over my life now, I've probably gone to a number of maybe 4 different therapists, sometimes for relationship. I've been in a relationship for 25 years and we've had to have little tune-ups here and there. So no, I use it as a mechanic on a car, on my truck. I mean, if my truck's not working properly, it gets serviced every. So I'm not going to lie that, yeah, I think it's good for people to just see their mental health as something. I wouldn't be here, Jerry, if I hadn't come across you probably. I honestly think that. So it's kept me ticking along and having a really interesting life.
That's a beautiful description, really, of how therapy, counselling can be a real support. And in many ways, how you can get a different perspective. But, I mean, one of the ways I like to think of it is that in therapy, we get another perspective because, you know, when we are going through something, we've got all our baggage and all our background and all our history. So we see things in a certain way. And when we go and be with someone, or in some cases in groups, I love to do therapy groups as well, where you get a group of people, all of whom are sort of sharing, you know, that actually there are issues in life that affect us, but you get different perspectives. And very often in a group, one of the sort of loveliest techniques I use is someone says, you know, well, I want to talk about this, and we get a nice agreement. And I said, well, how about at the end, you hear what each person, what solution they have, and you can choose if any of them work for you. And so the person tells their story, as it were. And then each member of the group says, well, I think you should be doing this, or I think you should be doing that. And it's absolutely amazing because every single person has a different perspective on each person's material. So every single listener here is going to be, you know, hearing and responding slightly differently. And something about just going into a safe, private, confidential space, just laying out your situation, if nothing else, having another individual who's not caught up in the same history as you are or I am, and they listen to us, and you go, oh, yeah. Having a different perspective can be so powerful, can't it?
Oh, absolutely. And I will say here today, hand on heart, I would never do group therapy. For whatever reason, I just could never do it. But certainly going into that, that's the stoicism. I just can't do that sort of thing. I'm not really a group kind of person. But going to her and all the female therapists I've had, I haven't had male, actually. I just more circumstantial than anything else, has really at least, because they're not caught up in the drama. And, you know, it does feel a little bit self-indulgent at times to talk to someone about your feelings, but sometimes it's so cathartic too. So, yeah, and I would say from 1 year to the next, I don't go to a therapist, but there are times when I go in a cluster because I realise I'm going off track and it's all, you know. But, yeah, no, I definitely admire what you do and respect it. And so I guess I'm a little bit different in that respect from my ancestors.
Yes, and in case you're wondering what you're listening to Reality Check Radio. This is Real People in the Psychotherapist Chair with me, Jerry Pives, and you're hearing Rachel Stewart share stories from her past, from her childhood, and the impact of those stories and those experiences. And what we're really exploring that I think I find so fascinating, Rachel, is we're exploring the roots of how we think and feel. And these farming roots that don't just go back to New Zealand, but actually by the sound of it, go all the way back to Britain. And do you know if your ancestors from the British end of things were, you said they were from the north of England. I actually spent 28 years of my life literally living on the border between Lancashire and Yorkshire. Do you know if they were farmers then, or do you know if they were other things? Do you know anything about that?
My father's side, I don't know so much. There was a bit of industry involved there, I think. My father's side, there was a lot of working in the Preston factories, I suppose. But yep. My mother's side, definitely, it was generation after generation after generation of her maiden name was such that if you go to a particular cemetery in the Pennines, called in a village called Dentdale, you will see her maiden name plastered all over the graves of this cemetery, going back to some, I think the last one that my uncle went and saw was 1600 something, and it was the same name. So, and it's an uncommon name. And so we just throughout Yorkshire everywhere, and probably, you know, you could argue that we're all inbred and a little bit weird, but who would know? I mean, I don't know. But that's where her family came from, and they were just generations of sheep farmers. Yep.
How far back were the first Kiwi farmers in your family then? Was it your grandfather?
It was my, on my mother's side, it was my great-grandfather, I think. And on my father's side, again, my great-grandfather, who came because he got a ballot farm from England. And he'd been a, you know, soldier, and so he ended up obviously taking Maori land, I'm sure, on the banks of the Whanganui River. We had a farm. And, two generations from me, but it carries on in some form or another now. It's pretty much there. I'm third generation New Zealander.
And these ballot farms, they were after the First World War, were they?
Yes. It was 14. Sorry, he got it after, I'm pretty sure he got it after the Boer War. And then he went from New Zealand back to World War One, over to England. So he was sent back and went back over. And my oldest uncle ran the farm, the oldest son, because Dad was the youngest of six. So, yeah, he went back. So I think it was after Boer War, which was 1896, maybe, something like that. I do know the First World War. God. So he'd been here quite a long time. Anyway, he died pretty young anyway. He died of a ulcer that burst in his stomach because of all the stress, I'm sure, and that was the end of him.
And isn't it amazing, Rachel, this pattern of trauma, in this case through war, both for your stepfather and your great-grandfather, trauma leading to, and I say trauma without any support or help to understand how to deal with that. And then we have the all-time solution to the pain that trauma brings, which is either drugs or alcohol. And very often with alcohol, we lose the inhibitions, and then the rage and the upset pours out in violence. This, you know, trauma, alcohol, violence. I wonder how many listeners can relate to that pattern in their own family right now as people are listening. And it all comes back to, what do we do with trauma, right?
Yeah, where do you put it? I mean, I drink, and I sometimes worry if I drink too much. I don't think I do. I've always drunk. When we finished hay making when we were a kid, we'd get made shandies, you know. And when we were older, we were allowed a beer. And I have so many good memories of watching the rugby and being able to have a beer with Dad. And so my memories of alcohol, because my father drank, but he wasn't violent at all. So he was a very gentle man, actually. He didn't pick up on any of that stuff. He was too young, I think, to get it from his father. I don't know, but he was a gentle person. My memories of alcohol are pretty good. For me, alcohol is a relaxant and has good memories, except around my stepfather, no. But, yeah, generally it's a good feeling for me, and I don't know if that's good or bad, but it is what it is. And I certainly don't see it as a problem in my life. It doesn't affect my life particularly.
Well, it's very interesting around the issue of alcohol. There's all sorts of ways that people use to evaluate that. And I think one of them is whether the people around you regard it as a problem. I think there'll be quite a few listeners who have had to stop drinking entirely because they can't maintain it. It's like it becomes accumulative and it grows and grows and grows and it gets out of control till you get to the binge and then you get to all the damage that it can do. I think there are lots of different views around that. But, you know, in general, I think the classic one is 21 units a week would qualify you as an alcoholic and 20 units wouldn't. So it's like...
I'll go with that.
And I think it's really interesting, Rachel, because alcohol in New Zealand is a very big problem. And I think, you know, the difficulty is when it starts to impact health or it impacts your functioning or it impacts your relationships. I think those are generally the indicators that people have for certainly people in my world. We say, well, how is it affecting you and what's happening? And you know, in my approach, it's like rather than saying that I need to change something because I'm guilty, it's, well, do you need to change it? Why do you need to change it? And what might the impact of changing it be? And you're describing really a cultural root of alcohol, which I think is such an important subject. And at the end of the day, Rachel, I have no doubt from talking with you that if you decided it was harming you or your relationships or your functioning, you'd knock it on the head overnight. I got that feeling about you.
Yeah, I would. If it got out of control, I would. And I'd know. You're definitely right there. Yeah.
So, Rachel, wow, I can't believe it, but we've run out of time, actually. We're coming to the end of this session. I wonder how you found it sitting here chatting in the psychotherapist chair with me, what it's been like for you.
Just how bloody sane I am, really. But also, you've got a very warm, golden, syrupy voice. You feel very calm. You are very balanced, and you don't feel like some people can feel like when you're talking to them, like they're killing you with kindness or coddling you or something. I don't like that. So no, it feels good. It's actually been good. I was a little bit nervous last night thinking about it. What it was going to be like, but no, this feels absolutely fine. So I've enjoyed talking to you, Jerry.
On behalf of the listeners, I just want to say a big thank you. You give absolutely masses. You speak out. You say things that many of us couldn't formulate as well as you do. You write amazingly. You're a real truth speaker, and sometimes that might agree with what I think, and sometimes it doesn't. I just love the fact that you're out there strutting your stuff, speaking out, you know, and I just want to say an enormous thank you for your courage. I know you think it's just normal, but for many listeners, I'm sure they're going to say, well, a world without Rachel Stewart would be a much more scary place, and having you out there swinging the mat for us is a real, real wonderful image to have.
Thank you. I appreciate that. That's very nice.
So, listeners, look, don't go away yet because I'm going to do some reflections. There have been lots of interesting things coming up here. And then I'm going to ask Rachel back to share her music with meaning. So hang on in because Rachel's going to give us even more stories about her life and the music that has really done for her and helped her through her life. So hang on in there. But Rachel Stewart, thank you so much for having the courage to come out and sit right here in the psychotherapist chair. Thank you once again.
This is Real People in the Psychotherapist Chair with Jerry Pives on RCR, Reality Check Radio.
Wow, what a great interview that was with Rachel Stewart. But as I said, don't go away. We've got a few minutes now where I'm going to be reflecting on that. And I'm going to be sharing with you probably one of the most powerful ideas I've ever come across in all my life as a therapist and transactional analyst, which is the idea of script, or more accurately, life script. So if you want to find out one of the secrets of the universe, then just hang on in here and let's go into reflections. And to get us into reflections, I'm changing my piece of music. I'm trying out something different. Let me know what you think. And if you have beautiful reflective pieces of music you'd like me to play, send in a recommendation. This piece today, The River Flows In You by the highly talented Yurima. Well, that was the beautiful River Flows In You by Yurima. What a beautiful piece of music. And that kicks us off, doesn't it, into a short period of just reflecting on that really interesting interview with Rachel. And I think one of the things that sticks with me after that interview is how much we returned again and again to early experiences and the impact those early experiences had on Rachel, but also, more importantly, has on all of us. And I do get it, you know, I really do get it, that the idea that we're not independently deciding our behaviors and acting on free will all the moment and all the time is a little bit disconcerting, isn't it? I do get that. But in a lifetime spent helping people understand themselves and change things in their lives or their relationships or their health or their work, in all of that time, I have found myself returning again and again to one of the most fundamental concepts in transactional analysis called script. And I'm going to give you a mini teach on script. Script really explains just why it is we sometimes find ourselves doing the same old that we really don't like ourselves doing, and how we often end up in situations that are unpleasant, but actually have a strangely familiar ring to them. Yeah. I think the most comic expression of that is different partner, same relationship. That would be a very good expression of that. So what we're looking at here is a concept called script. Now, this goes right back to Freud. It goes all the way back to Freud. Freud noticed in his work that people repeat certain patterns of behavior. And I'm sure if you think about it, you can think of not only in your own life, but in other people's lives, how people seem to keep repeating the same old, even though they or we know it doesn't work. Here we are again. And Freud called this the repetitive compulsion, like we have a compulsion to repeat. And Eric Byrne, who started life very much as a Freudian, but then developed a much more accessible approach to psychoanalysis and psychotherapy, he reframed a lot of what Freud said in some very clear and concise ways. And what he said was, really what happens is when we're very, very little and very young, we develop certain patterns of survival based on the situation we find ourselves in. Now, no two babies find themselves in exactly the same situation, even in families. At birth and in during gestation and during the pregnancy, the birth is different, the pregnancy is different, and very often the early years are different. You know, the first child has a different experience from the second child, and so on and so forth. And what Byrne said is that basically we have a very early decisional element within us, a survivor, if you like, and you see this in babies, but they come up with sort of solutions, not consciously thought out like you and I would, but very, very early. And these solutions develop and get reinforced through life. And Byrne said they end up being like scripts that have almost three acts, like a play in the theater, you know, a first act, a second act, and a third act. And what he said was, is you don't really, really know what a script is until you visit the cemeteries and you see written on the tombstones of people how their life ended and also how their life was lived. Obituaries, if you like. And I'm very fond of telling the story of the Nobel Peace Prize by Alfred Nobel. Did you know that his determination to set aside large sums of money for philanthropy, for good, for rewarding good behavior, all came about because he was in Paris and he was trundling down a pavement and he sat in his favorite cafe to have his favorite morning cafe au lait or whatever it was he was drinking, opened up the newspaper, and the newspaper had mistakenly printed his obituary. So he's sitting there on a Sunday or Saturday morning, opening up his newspaper, and he reads that he's dead. A mild shock, to say the least. Anyway, he read his obituary, and that obituary was not very nice. The obituary, mistakenly put in by the newspaper, the obituary said, "The Merchant of Death is dead," I think is what the title of the newspaper heading said. "The Merchant of Death is dead." And this was because Alfred Nobel made all his wealth and money from the production of dynamite and TNT and explosives, which actually became the tool for armies and everything like that. This is in the 19th century, and wars were already becoming, you know, even more horrendous than they had been, you know, because of the introduction of the cannon and the gunpowder and all of that stuff. And much of that was from Alfred Nobel. And he was so shocked. He kind of got this preview of his own tombstone or his own obituary. And what happened to Alfred Nobel was he was so shocked at seeing his script that he decided there and then to turn his life around towards philanthropy, hence the Nobel Peace Prize. Not many people are aware of this backstory to the Nobel Peace Prize, especially not in terms of the psychology and our script. So what we have is a definition of script that Eric Byrne, the founder of transactional analysis, came up with, and I'm going to read that out to you. He said the script was an unconscious life plan made in childhood, reinforced by the parents, justified by subsequent events. And that comes from what I think was his very best book, which is What Do You Say After You Say Hello? And to be honest, if there's any book about TA you want to read, that's the one I would recommend. What Do You Say After You Say Hello? It's a brilliant, bright, sparkling book full of all sorts of examples. And although it is of its time in the 70s, it's my desert island book, I'm afraid. So I guess I'm a bit of a geek in that way, a psychology geek. Anyway, so what a script explains is it explains why things don't always seem to work out. Because remember, the first part of that definition is that it is an unconscious life plan. And the great thing about that is if we become conscious of it and we become aware of it, we can actually change it, just as Alfred Nobel changed it for himself. So it's an unconscious life plan, and that it's made in childhood. And as I suggested early on, really, that very first experience of life, the being carried in the womb, the birth, the very first year of life, all the research is showing that that really has more and more impact on us. So this life plan is unconscious, partly because it is made as a survival behavior in our very early childhood. And that includes what happened to our mothers while they were carrying us in the womb, how the birth was, how the first year. We kind of had very little conscious thought. We didn't understand words, but we instinctively start to form a pattern of behavior and survival. And in these early years, there's almost like a protocol set out, that there's a early script protocol. It's not like a verbal thing. It's an instinct. It's a very early layer. And then it becomes reinforced by our parents. And very often, what our parents do is they share their best survival strategies, sometimes by words and more often by behavior. So we get our survival strategies, our life plan, our repetitive compulsion. We build that up, and it's now becoming very, very unconscious. It's just a habit. And then as we go through life, because of our behaviors and our life plan and the way we're operating, we tend to get the same results over and over again. So there you have probably a very condensed but succinct definition of script, which is an unconscious life plan made in childhood, reinforced by the parents, and justified by subsequent events. And that is how today we think about why life doesn't work out. But, you know, these days, it's not the only way that we talk about this, because a long time ago in history, the Greeks sort of tried to explain this by using their mythologies of gods, you know, and the gods were often not very nice. You know, the very stories of the gods are full of quite malicious supernatural powers that are stopping us from living our life. And some of the stories of the gods, you think of the myth of Sisyphus, for example. You know, here was someone who dared to be a god, and his punishment was to push a stone up the hill, but never, ever reach the top of the hill. So he would get close to the top and then the stone would roll down again. And a Sisyphus life script is one where we keep trying, we keep trying, we keep trying, but we never quite make it. I wonder if you can relate to that or know people who seem to live their lives out like that. Another frustrating life script would be the story of Tantalus. You know, the Greek story of Tantalus was that Tantalus, you know, for punishment, was stuck in a pond where he couldn't drink the water. Every time he leaned forward to drink the water when he was thirsty, it just went away. And food was displayed for him, but he couldn't reach it. So this eternal sort of frustration, and so on and so forth. In the Middle Ages, in the more common culture, we have fairy tales. And fairy tales are really the Greek myths of the people. And some of the fairy tales are very, very old. And these were stories that traveling storytellers would travel from village to village and sit around the village fire and tell these stories. And they kind of expressed the psyche, the archetypes, and the psychological structure of the people. If you didn't tell a story that resonated for people, you weren't invited back. No grub, no clothing. It was a tough time for storytellers. So the fairy tale stories actually speak of life scripts. And again, the forces that, as it were, stop us from living the life that we really dream of and wish for are reflected in like malicious witches and ogres and malevolent stepmothers, just like the Greeks had their malevolent gods, you know, who were punishing the people. So the fairy tales have all sorts of characters that get in the way. And if we think about a life script, like say the Ugly Duckling, you know, that would be it's a more modern fairy tale, but Hans Christian Andersen grew up in a very traditional culture and actually described the Ugly Duckling story as not only a story that was based on, you know, his experiences of hearing these ancient fairy tales, but he actually described it as his autobiography. The story of the Ugly Duckling is a perfect example of a life script. It's a very good one, actually, in the end. But think about it. He's abandoned by his real parents and he's brought up by ducks. He's a swan, of course. He's not a duck at all. So the Ugly Duckling grows up being told all sorts of negative messages. He's not quite right. He doesn't look right, you know, and he has to try and fit in as a duck, you know, but as a young cygnet, he's just going to struggle with that. So the Ugly Duckling ends up, when he grows up and leaves the duckling home, as it were, when he goes out into the real world, he's still operating according to a script that says he doesn't belong, he's not right, and he's got everything wrong with him. And guess what happens to him? Everywhere he goes, he gets rejected. Guess what that does? It reinforces his belief that he's not right. And it's only at the very end of the story, when a swan flies by or a bunch of swans fly by, depending on which story you read, and they go, oh, you know, why don't you come fly with us? And the Ugly Duckling says, what do you mean? I'm a duck. You know? And then the swan says, look at yourself in the water. And he sees the mirror and he sees who he really is. And he flies away with the other swans. And I love that story because psychologically it tells us that, you know, what happened to us has a massive impact. Our behavior reinforces it. We're actually the creator of our own disasters. And so analyzing that and understanding that and then working out what our scripts are about and why they developed, because all our scripts weren't developed by malicious gods or anything. They were developed by us in order to adapt to a situation when we are utterly powerless as babies. So script is one of these ideas that we get caught up in repetitive patterns. And that's why you need an outsider to help you with this. It's not because you're incapable. It's not because you're somehow weak. It's not because you're somehow, you know, failing in your life. It's just that we are locked into our own scripts. We see the world through these scripts. So how on earth are we going to completely understand this from our own perspective? No, we need someone locked in another script that is different from ours, so they're not susceptible to the influences that we had. So it becomes very important to get that help, because otherwise we're locked into what we call our own frame of reference, and we filter out anything that doesn't fit in with our script. This is the most important thing to understand, is that the script we're living under, and we're all living under our own scripts, that we filter out anything that does not fit with that script belief or that script behavior. And so we don't really see anything that challenges our script. And that's why going to see a therapist or a counselor or a coach can be quite challenging, because we're kind of going, let's have a look at that from a different perspective. And it's that difference of perspective that really can make it hard work. But there's nothing wrong with going to see someone who's going to, as it were, reflect back to you your own beliefs and behavior from a different perspective. That's probably one of the best definitions of therapy I can come up with. And all the way through these radio programs, you can see this. You can see the history. It's why I love to go back and find out where people came from, where their ancestors came from, because these scripts, they do pass down generations with variation. There are all sorts of variations, which led Eric Byrne to suggest that we're not just receiving script, that we're engaging in its creation, even from a very early age. And, you know, if it's a story or a script that we wrote and we're following, then we can write another one. And that is the basis of probably all of my work. Well, I hope you found that interesting. We're going to move on to Music with Meaning. And to get us in the groove, for Rachel to come back and share her life in 7 tracks of music and why they're so important to her, let's get ourselves into the mood with the Doobie Brothers and listen to the music. Well, that was Listen to the Music by the iconic Doobie Brothers. And that's exactly what we're going to do. I've invited the lovely Rachel Stewart back into the psychotherapist chair, but this time we're going to be talking about the music that has meaning for her. And Rachel, thanks for coming back and doing this Music with Meaning segment with me.
Looking forward to it.
So let's dive in. Tell me what the first piece of music that has meaning for you that you've got for us, Rachel.
I chose the first one because it reminded me of my mother and my childhood, really. Wichita Lineman, Glen Campbell from 1968. And it has a lot of resonance for me.
You said something about you got this out of the Woolworths store. Is that right?
Yes. I was with my mother. It would have been 1971, I'm pretty sure, because the album came out, Glen Campbell's Greatest Hits. And she was really into it. And she said, I'm going to go and buy this LP. So off we went to the Woolworths store, back in the days when Woolworths was actually a, you know, general store. And it was in the main street of Whanganui. And I thought it was a very modern building, lots of glass. And it was a lovely day. And it all seemed good and well with the world. And she bought the album and listened to it endlessly. And I can remember the Wichita Lineman was on the radio a lot. And it just conjured up images of a windswept Kansas plains, where I'd never been at that point, but I obviously have since many times, and the isolation of that and the line, I hear you singing in the wire, you know, because on the farm I don't hear all the time the wind going through the power lines outside the house. That was something outside my bedroom that I used to hear. So it all really resonated for me, and it still does, and I love the song. And yeah, my world was about to change after she bought that album, because little did I know that soon we'd be, that my parents would be splitting up and I'd be moving to the US with my mother. So, you know, Kansas was one step closer.
Yeah, and it's a bit of history from before that big disruption to your life that you talked about with us. So yes, let's have a listen to Wichita Lineman. Well, that was Glenn Campbell singing Wichita Lineman. Rachel Stewart, moving on now, what's your second track that you've got for us?
I'm a Fleetwood Mac fan to me, they're just the best band that's ever been. But I chose Albatross because it was the sort of the earlier British incarnation of Fleetwood Mac before they became, you know, what they became in the 70s, which is a whole other California sound. But who cannot be transported by Albatross? It's just the most beautiful piece of music. It reminds me of my three older siblings who were listening to these sounds on the radio all the time because of the age gap between us. I was, you know, listening to Creedence Clearwater Revival and, you know, just you name it, the Seekers, you know. So I clearly picked it up by osmosis living with them, and I find this music very transporting back to that time when we were all one big happy family, I guess.
Wow, what a track. And it's just so spacious, I think is the word. And, you know, the idea of the sound, it's almost like a, you know, it's like a soundscape they create, isn't it? It's really, really beautiful and so relaxing and beautiful, beautiful. I'm sure quite a lot of our listeners are over 50 and they love this program because they often write in and say, oh, that reminded me of this period and this time. And you know, the same with Glenn Campbell, you know, listening to the songs that our parents played is also very powerful, I think, for a lot of people. So we're going to listen to Albatross by Fleetwood Mac. Well, that was the beautiful Albatross by Fleetwood Mac. And you're listening to Real People on Reality Check Radio with me, Joe Pives. And we've got the indomitable Rachel Stewart with us, who is sharing her music with meaning. Rachel, what's your third piece of music that you got lined up for us?
Yeah, well, I've moved into 1977, a huge hit for Linda Ronstadt, Blue Bayou. I think written by Roy Orbison, the great Roy Orbison. It's an extremely complex and difficult song to sing, and it would be because Roy Orbison would always sing complex and difficult songs because he had the voice that could do it. But Linda Ronstadt proved that she could too. And the lyrics to this song are just unbelievable. I mean, to this day, I find the song extremely comforting. It's an illustration of metaphorical heaven, I guess, called home, and a version of somewhere we all hope we're going to return to one day. Well, you know, who knows if that's going to happen, but sort of like our mother's arms. Wouldn't that be nice? Peace at last. So if you think of these words, and everyone pretty much knows Blue Bayou is if they're over a certain age, I'm going back someday, come what may, to Blue Bayou, where the folks are fun and the world is mine on Blue Bayou, where those fishing boats with their sails afloat. If I could only see that familiar sunrise through sleepy eyes, how happy I'd be.
You know, I almost tear up when I hear those words. There's something archetypal about, I mean, that could stand as a poem, you know, and then to have the amazing Linda Ronstadt. I wondered, because of the year of it, Rachel, whether it in any way reminded you of your San Francisco days as well.
Oh, yes, it did. It just reminds me of America, actually. It's a beautiful, Linda Ronstadt was huge. And at that time, it was a big hit. And it does, definitely.
Well, you're in for a treat. Let's listen to Blue Bayou by Linda Ronstadt. Well, that was Blue Bayou by the wonderful Linda Ronstadt, the voice of America in the 70s, eh? And Rachel Stewart, what's your fourth piece and why have you chosen it for us?
Yeah, it took a bit of choosing this one because I didn't think it would be something I would pick, but I decided that if I was going to be reminded of the 80s and reminded of my life at the time, this was a good one, actually. Blue Monday by New Order, 1983. Of course, Blue Monday and New Order were born out of Joy Division, and I was a big Joy Division fan. I mean, people remember Joy Division and Ian Curtis, he killed himself, and Love Will Tear Us Apart. So he was anything but joyous, but of course it was named more, it was a nod to the Nazi party and their Joy Division, which involved prostitutes, I understand. And it came out when I was 21 and it was on the album called Power, Corruption and Lies, which I thought was pretty faultless. Now, it's electronica. It's not everybody's thing, but how could you not dance to it? And I thought it was pretty flawless in the sense that it has survived to this day as a piece of music that people still get up and dance to. They love it. It's just got a great sound. It's iconic. And the electronica 80s beat at the time felt so cool, so avant-garde. And it reminds me of my gang of friends and flatmates, mostly who were my friends. And we were all just one big happy family and all the good times we had together going out dancing and just being young and relatively carefree. And it just meant for great times out. So it just reminds me of a good time.
So we're talking about the 1980s. So listeners, you just coif your hair and put on your power shoulder, the shoulder pad jackets, and get up and jive to Blue Monday by New Order. Well, that was Blue Monday by New Order. And you're listening to Reality Check Radio. This is Real People. And we've got Rachel Stewart here sharing her music with meaning. And Rachel, what's your next piece that you got lined up for us, and tell us why you chose it?
Yeah, well, this came out when I was 35, and it was a huge hit for The Verve in 1997 called Bittersweet Symphony. It's been, it was a massive hit. And it was, I just think the lyrics conjure up both the beauty and the difficulty of life in a near perfect symphonic kind of song. I was struggling with depression in my mid-30s, so this sort of really resonated, the lyrics, because it's a bittersweet symphony, that's life, trying to make ends meet, you're a slave to money, then you die. It felt like that's all that life was at the time. And singer Richard Ashcroft repeatedly asks in the song, have you ever been down? He just goes through it and through it. So, being down is quite boring, being depressed, but this song really reminds me of that time and climbing out of that pit.
Yeah, this is just one of those iconic sounds of a certain period, isn't it? The late 90s, and it really is the... I've got so many associations with this piece of music, Rachel. It just is... it's an awesome piece of music and such a symphony. I mean, it's just a symphony, right? It's just a modern symphony. It's beautiful.
It's a near-perfect song, actually, yeah.
I would agree. I would absolutely agree. There's something about it. And actually, I really enjoy, sometimes I've got time just playing it on the YouTube and looking at the video. It's a very powerful video, actually, that they did with the song as well. So listeners, you might want to go and have a look at that as well. But for now, we're just going to listen to The Verve playing Bittersweet Symphony. Well, you probably know what that piece was. And if you don't, you're probably brain dead. But that was Bittersweet Symphony by The Verve. Rachel Stewart, tell us what your next music with meaning is and why you've chosen it.
Well, actually, the next piece of music is by London Grammar. It came out in 2013. Now, London Grammar, funnily enough, covered the song you just played, Bittersweet Symphony by The Verve, on one of their albums. I can't remember which one, but it is the best cover I've ever heard. And I would argue that it's an even better version, if I can say that, but it's a fantastic version. Her voice, Hannah Reid, is stupendous. Anyway, this one is Strong by London Grammar, this song. And if people haven't heard of London Grammar, go and find out. The voice on the singer, Hannah Reid, is stupendous. She was opera trained, but ended up in this indie trio. I'm glad she did, because there's something about their music that I've yet to figure out why it means something to me, maybe I don't need to. But if you want to hear a beautiful voice, this is it in a modern context. So this piece of music too just takes me back to a surprisingly happy time in my life when we were living at the beach on the Capri Coast for a couple of years, and I was heavily involved in looking after my niece's kids, so my great-niece and great-nephews, and I got involved because they were working hard and they were in their 30s and they needed help. And I thought, oh, I'll go and help. And it was nothing to me to change a nappy, and before that I'd never thought much about doing that kind of thing. And I just love those kids, and they're growing up steadily now and they're in, secondary school, close to one of them. This is what it reminds me of. And it was playing a lot in the early 2010s. And yeah, London Grammar, I think you'll enjoy it.
You've just been listening to Strong by London Grammar. What a beautiful, beautiful piece of music that was. And Rachel Stewart, this is your seventh and last track. What have you got for us?
Yeah, I'm going right back to 1961. I wasn't even born yet, but getting close. 62 I was born. Patsy Cline, I mean, come on. You can't go past her voice. Katie Lang always said, who's also a great, fantastic singer, that she was the reincarnation of Patsy Cline. She felt. I'm sure she isn't, but who knows? This Patsy Cline has got just an amazing country voice. So crazy. How can you go past crazy even? I'm an unapologetic, unabashed, all-in, boots-and-all country music fan. If you want to know what I go to when I'm down the dumps or stressed or anxious, it's always my default music position. The voices in country music are the best, in my opinion, apart from opera, but that's not where I go to when I'm stressed. Even when you're talking about old dogs and broken-down trucks or lost love, country music soothes me. Any country, old, classic, new, bluegrass, you name it, I'm there. How to pick one song? It was very difficult. It was a toss-up here. But in the end, it was hard to go past the late and great Patsy Cline.
Well, Rachel, thank you so much. For a psychotherapist, a track labeled Crazy is just perfect, I have to say. So I think I'll be coming up with that one again and using that myself.
Yeah, fair enough.
But we're going to listen. Well, we're going to bow out from this time together with Patsy Cline singing Crazy. And once again, I just want to say a big heartfelt thank you for not just for being on this program, but for all that you do and all the truth and the free speech and the desire to make sure that, you know, if we're going to lose this battle, we'll go down fighting, right?
Dead right. Till the end.
Well, very appropriately, you've just been listening to Crazy by Patsy Cline. And we've run out of time. I can't read out any letters, I'm afraid. There's no time, but I'll read them out in a fortnight's time at my next show on a Saturday morning and Sunday afternoon. And if you're missing me on the off weeks when I'm not here, just listen in on the repeats. Got over 30 shows lined up that you can catch up on. I'm sure you haven't heard them all. And do keep writing, and whenever I get a moment, I will be replying to them. Thank you so much. And here's wishing you and your loved ones every blessing over the next 2 weeks.
Thanks for tuning in to Real People with Jerry Pives. Do you have a guest suggestion for Jerry? If you know someone who has an interesting life story, maybe that someone is you, then please get in touch. Jerry would love to get your feedback, so please send us a text on 2057 or email us at inbox@realitycheck.radio to let us know your thoughts about his show. That's your message to 2057 or inbox@realitycheck.radio. Normal texting charges apply.